This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. 8 years ago, Julia Franks and her husband bought a farm in western North Carolina. The 1800s farmhouse on the land was still standing. When they walked in the doors, they were greeted by dozens of odd artifacts. There were animal bones, locks of hair, insect hives, and even a jar with a fingernail from the 1950s. Julia is a high school literature teacher and a lover of writing, so when she encountered all this stuff, it was hard for her not to let her imagination run wild. She became curious about why someone would keep objects like this and what story the artifacts told about the lives of the couple who once lived there. The ideas inspired her debut novel, Over the Plain Houses. It's set in 1930s and 40s Appalachia and told from two perspectives, a husband and wife named Irene and Brodus. Julia is going to be reading from her novel at bookstores all around the state, but first she joins me in the studio. Julia Franks, welcome to the State of Things. Nice to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here.
Take us back now when you first entered this old farmhouse and describe, you know, kind of what it was like, what you saw and kind of how you felt.
Well, you know, whenever you're in somebody else's house and they're not inviting you in, they're not, you know, giving you a tour, you feel like an intruder, you know, and it feels feels like a really personal thing to look at somebody else's stuff, even if it's just everyday, you know, mundane items. It feels like a very intimate thing to do. And these particular people, I think it was the wife, they were savers, you know.
And, well, you know, maybe photographs. We might have a couple of artifacts from, we might have an old program from our prom. But a jar with a fingernail. Labeled,
I don't have one of those either.
Well, I'm saying.
You know, but I'll tell you what, the more people I talk to, the more people have said to me, I've saved this and I've saved that. And, you know, people, we try to hold on to these moments, you know, and I didn't ever meet these people because they were long, long dead. But sparks your imagination.
So did it happen right there? Again, tell us about the fingernail. Did I said from the 1950s, and you know that because it actually said
right.
Where it was from, right? I mean, just to give you an idea, and other artifacts as well. So did you light up immediately, see all this stuff, and begin to think, oh, there's a story in this, or did it take you time?
It took some time. You know, if you're a writer and you stumble on this treasure trove, I mean, there were also letters and diaries and homework. It is really hard not to have your imagination fired up. Yeah.
You did find out, you said you'd never met the couple who lived there, but you did find out about the husband and wife a little bit. And they were unusual.
They were unusual folks. The husband was a circuit preacher, and his wife had worn a splint bonnet until 1973. So you find people like that, you know, still in the Western Carolina mountains who are, they're just living an earlier, you know, lifestyle.
Well, the book that you've written now, your novel, is set in the 1930s and 40s Appalachia. So give us some context for what was happening in the region at that time.
Yes. It's really the 20s and 30s was a time when the government was very involved in Appalachia, trying to improve, and I'll put quotations around that word, trying to improve the area by sending in various agencies to help people change the way they farmed, to help housewives change the way they tended their gardens and their homes. And of course, there were a lot of kind of do-good organizations getting involved in Appalachia, and also charity organizations, and also churches. You know, you had, at that time period, there were a lot of grassroots churches. These are organizations whereby one person decided they want to start a church, you know, and they're called to do so, and they set up the church, and they call it whatever they call it. But then you would have, let's say, the National Organization of Southern Baptists. They don't really like it when somebody else calls themselves Baptist and they're not affiliated with the national organization and they're doing their own thing. So you had this kind of interesting conflict between these national religious organizations and these grassroots ones. And, you know, say what you want about the grassroots churches. These people were not getting paid. No. They were just volunteers. They were doing it out of their own passion.
Yeah, and they probably knew more about the needs, spiritual and otherwise, of the folks who live there than people from the outside.
Right.
And this is a central tension then, and becomes one of the central tensions in the book itself. Virginia comes in from the outside, one of these sort of government experts, and she develops a relationship with Irini. Tell us about that and how that develops.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the way women make friends in general, but Virginia Furman comes in, and she's a government worker, and she's there, you know, she wants to do good, and but she makes some pretty big missteps because she doesn't really understand where she's come to, and there's this kind of back and forth dance, which I think is often the case with when people are making new friends, you know, and in some ways, yes, there's the marriage, which is a central relationship, but this relationship between these two women is also, to me, very central to the plot line.
Yeah, and that dance, I think, is where some of the subtlety comes in. I mean, if we were simply to imagine an outsider coming in with their expert advice to a place that is somewhat insular to begin with, we could imagine tension, friction, and a kind of a, you know, a sort of a cold shoulder.
Yeah.
Not paying attention at all, or perhaps outright antagonism, but it doesn't happen. There's a kind of courtesy initially between the two. And ultimately, Virginia the outsider stirs in Irini a kind of new sense of the world around her, right?
Yes, she does. And, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm very interested in how women, especially once their kids are grown, how they make friends. And like a lot of women wait to be picked. I don't know if men do this, but I see it in women all the time. They wait for somebody else to pick them. And
now, men mostly wait for someone to just, like, feed them.
Maybe that's all they do.
Or they would starve.
Yeah. Well, okay.
All right.
But, you know, the result of waiting to be picked is that you either are lonely or you end up with friends you don't necessarily really like, you know? And Irini's kind of like that. She waits for somebody to pick her, and Virginia Furman kind of picks her and chooses and approaches her.
Which is different than the marriage, which is you sort of fall into that. That's what you do up here. And then the idea that someone saw something in you, that's a different kind of, awakens a different sense in Irini. I wonder if you could, there's a passage that you might read from us. From Irini's perspective, the book is told from two perspectives, and maybe this would help us understand, and you could set it up for us.
Okay, she has come to this habit of wandering around in the middle of the night. She'd wake up in the middle of the night and she'll take these walks. And this is sort of her state of mind that she sort of explains how she kind of explains herself. She'd come to hate the root cellar. All wintered, she'd inventoried there, sitting in the dank with the fust and the mold nudging at the door. Cull the apples, unwrap the sweet potatoes, put the potatoes by, set the squash out for cooking before it was too late. She was the keeper of the house and the yard and the fields. She'd cooked and put up all manner of food. In the root cellar, in the weak air, the lamp guttered and the flame bowed and wickered. Only the bluest center stayed constant, low between the lamp's brass thumbs. And on days when she overspent her time there, she found herself staring into its gentian eye. She was tired of being inside.
Julia Franks reading from her debut novel, Over the Plain Houses. She'll be reading around the state, and you can go to her website, stateofthings.org, to find out where and when she'll be speaking and reading. So here she is, Irini, awakened now, a sense of herself is reflected in this interest from an outsider, and now she begins these nighttime wanderings. Brodus, her husband, begins to notice, too. He's none too happy about this. Maybe you can set up Brodus for us and tell us a bit about him.
So Brodus is, you know, he's a man of principle, and he's a man who's decided that he wants to follow the Bible literally, sort of no matter where that takes him. He is constantly striving to meet that goal. But he sees a footprint on the in the frost one morning. And that's how he begins to know that something is not right. His eye might have seen it first, but his mind didn't record it right off. Then it did. An oval print amongst the spears of frost. He stopped. For a moment, he considered going back to the plow, returning to this spot only after the sun had burned the mark away. 10 minutes was all it would take, and the white cauled earth would brown again. Just walk away. But no, that wasn't the promise he'd made to himself whenever he'd taken up with the Lord. He'd sworn to confront the truth head on. Brodus shifted his weight and swung the bad foot around. For some reason, he thought of the lady agent. No, not for some reason, for a very particular reason, for the reason that here came a woman driving an automobile up somewhere she didn't belong, and not 2 days later, he, Brodus, was finding the footprint of a woman where it didn't belong.
Author Julia Franks reading from her debut novel, Over the Plain Houses. And so for Irini, this newcomer is an awakening, a sense of an inner self that she was never aware of. For Brodus, this newness is really overturning a kind of privilege. This is the way things are here. And by the way, I'm privileged by that. And it's fascinating to see, you know, sort of how these two characters then, how their relationship evolves from that point forward. But there's also a bit of the, as this evolves in Brodus, the kind of white rage, the sort of resentful white guy in him. I mean, is that something that's sort of conscious in your mind as you developed his character?
You know, when I wrote this book, it wasn't that conscious in my mind. It was around the time that there was the first, one of the first explicitly political shootings that happened at my parents' church in Tennessee. And that sparked this awareness of, this kind of frustration. I think that's out there. And I think it's actually increased since I started writing the book. And, what do you do with that kind of frustration? And Brodus has good reason to be frustrated. He's lost a lot in recent years, and he is trying to be a better person. What do you do with that frustration?
Well, because he's in one sense privileged in his own little way, but the larger system that he finds himself in, the larger economic and political system, has him way down on the pecking order. And so, as we do, we sort of look for the next rung down. Tell us about the decision then to write this from two different perspectives.
For me, novels start with questions, and one of my central questions about the novel was, how does a guy like Brodus get to where he is, and what does he do with that? And I knew it was going to be told from Brodus's point of view, but honestly, there had to be a balance. There had to be
Waking you up in the middle of the night saying, "Hey, what about me?"
Right, exactly. and then Irini was, she's closer to who I am because I'm female, but she came up more organically in my mind, but Brodus was really the main question that made me start this book. Yeah.
This is your first novel and you teach. Have you been thinking about writing a novel for a long time? Has this been an interest of yours, or was it simply the fact that there was a jar full of crazy stuff that got you thinking, this is it, this is the day?
Well, I actually have been writing for probably 12 years. Mm-hmm. This is the first novel that I've actually completed. So, if you teach literature, you're swimming in literature all the time, and it's hard not to let your mind go there.
Yeah,
Is
that intimidating? I've often wondered that the greatest obstacle, or a great obstacle for a first time writer or a young writer, is this the weight of great literature, in the sense that your first book isn't going to be that. Does that present a kind of an obstacle?
Honestly, I wasn't thinking I'm going to write great literature. I wasn't thinking that.
No, well, that's probably helpful, isn't it?
Yeah? I was just thinking I'm going to write about this idea that's sort of obsessing me. So,
Well, it's great stuff, and I'm happy to have you on the show with us, Julia Franks, talking about her debut novel, Over the Plain Houses. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julia is going to be reading from her book at Lanier Library in Tryon on August 16th, McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh, and the Country Bookshop in Southern Pines on August 20th. And we have all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.